The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Many of you will remember the film Amadeus, or the play Amadeus, on which it was based. And however inaccurate a lot of the historical detail was in that film about Mozart, the theme of the film was something that I've been thinking about ever since. You remember the two main characters are, of course, Mozart and the gifted, talented wonder child, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, who in the movie is portrayed as somewhat of an awkward scoundrel. And then the other character was Salieri. We wouldn't know much about him probably if it weren't for this movie, although he was a rather important, though minor, composer. And the theme of the film is, of course, why does God, it seems almost arbitrarily, with his love, give his gifts to people who don't seem to have the character or the disposition to merit them? And why does the earnest, duty-bound, hard-working person sometimes get less gifts? It isn't fair. I work at a seminary where I feel like Salieri all the time. And the reason is I'm surrounded by Mozarts of theology. Now, this comparison is particularly apt when we're talking about the speaker who is going to lead our theological meditation tonight. Dan McCartney can do all of the high-level technical work of New Testament studies that his discipline requires. He's written numerous articles and one excellent book on hermeneutics, which is our fancy word for biblical interpretation. The book is called Let the Reader Understand. And it's so clearly written that I understood the book. He's also in a project to revise Machen's Greek, Introduction to New Testament Greek, which is for many of us the book that we pretended to learn Greek on. But the thing about Dan is that he's much more than a pure technician. He's also a marvelous human being who has pastoral gifts, though he probably doesn't think he does. My favorite book of Dan's is a book called Why Does It Have to Hurt? As soon as I saw it, I made it required reading in my introduction to apologetics class. It is, in my judgment, the best book that I know on suffering and on answers to hard questions about why it does have to hurt. And to make it really unfair, Dan is a superb musician. He plays the French horn, and he could have gone into it as a profession, but he got sidetracked, as some of us have, from music into theology. But he still plays, and he plays with the Westminster Brass. And then to cap it all off, and this is really unfair, Dan is an extremely nice and humble person. Dan is going to lead us in a study of the gospel and the arts. Dan, thank you very much.
Sit down now so that that illusion is preserved. I thought that when he started talking about Mozart and mentioned Mozart's problematic character, I thought that that was what he was going to compare me. Since I share a birthday with Mozart, that would have been appropriate, I suppose. Tonight I want to speak to you about divine beauty and human art. Ever since Luther and Calvin, Reformed and Protestant Christians have rightly rejected the philosophy of asceticism, which tries to isolate people from their aesthetic sensibilities. Calvin, in his Institute, says, "Away then with that inhuman philosophy that by allowing only necessary use of created things, not only maliciously deprives us of the lawful fruit of God's beneficence, but cannot be practiced without robbing a man of all his senses and degrading him to a block." Well, I wish I could write like that, because then I could really accomplish something in the world. But I think that his understanding there forms a kind of starting point for us. However, most Christians today think of art as little more than a matter of personal enjoyment. Art is just okay. It's a nice add-on, a luxury, an optional ornamentation that brings a lawful pleasure if there happens to be time and resources left over from the important things. Art is therefore regarded as a matter of personal preference. And hence, the decrials of elitism and artistic snobbery that beset any who try to raise the standard of Christian artistic expression. I suggest to you this evening that there is much more to art than personal enjoyment. It is a creaturely obligation for a being who is created in God's image. We are as obligated to exercise our aesthetic capacities, both in enjoying the beauty of God's creation and in creating in response to that beauty, as we are obligated to think and reason soundly. God has created us with the urge not just to procreate, but to create. He expects us to create, appreciate, and manifest beauty in our lives. Let me pause here. Some people of philosophical bent may quibble with the fact that it's hard to define beauty, but I don't think you need to define it in order to know what it is. So I'm not going to define it. Most Christians know that they have social and religious obligations. God demands that they behave in certain ways toward their neighbors and towards himself. Many Christians, especially those from our Reformed tradition, are also aware that they have intellectual obligations. God requires them to have correct thoughts. But people are also aesthetic beings. They are conscious of, take pleasure in, and inevitably desire to create beauty. They desire to impose and manifest order, beauty, and harmony, not just functionality in their lives. Why? Because the aesthetic dimension of our lives is an aspect of our imageness. Our likeness to God does not only consist in the ability to speak, or in the ability to reason, or in our wills, or in our moral nature, although all these things are essential, of course. Our imageness also consists in our ability to appreciate and to create beauty. God is a creator of beauty, a beauty that manifests his own character. Psalm 19 tells us that the heavens declare the glory of God and the earth proclaims his handiwork. The beauty of the product reflects the beauty within the producer. Heaven's glory echoes God's glory. It is therefore just as important that we engage in the manifestation and creation of beauty as it is that we engage in science. Manifestation and creation of beauty as a reflection of the one creator and manifester is not optional. It is not an add-on or a luxury or a little extra bonus that God made just to make us feel good. As bearers of the divine image, we have an obligation to art. Now, Christianity has always had a very uneasy relationship to art. One reason for this unease is that the arts are associated with entertainment. Even before the secularization of art and its exaltation to something that exists only for its own sake, the church was uneasy because the arts have always had association with pleasure and enjoyment. When pleasure was regarded as a threat to holiness, enjoyment was seen as distracting. Tertullian, for example, a theologian writing in the early 3rd century, wrote a vigorously vituperative pamphlet against any use of art because it would distract the believer from the pure, unearthly experience of the beauty of God. In the Middle Ages, the ambivalence continued. For the most part, however, the medieval church loved beauty as a reflection of God's beauty. The real or visible beauty was seen as imitating the ideal beauty of God, and the ideal beauty is to a large degree knowable by way of that which is visible. The theologian Hugh of St. Victor, for example, declared that the world is like a book written by the finger of God. And he claimed that visible beauty is an image of invisible beauty. Since beauty is an attribute of God that is reflected in his creation, that beauty should be imitated by his image bearers, and hence art was to be honored in the church. Hence the medievalists strove to represent the divine beauty in magnificent buildings and great paintings. Unfortunately, they also tended to overdo art to the point of obscuring the truth of the gospel, substituting the delights of ornamentation for the true knowledge of God, and they often lost sight of the biblical principle that God is only to be worshipped according to his own mandates, which led the Protestant church during the Reformation back towards ambivalence. Most of the great reformers had a high appreciation of beauty and art, as we just heard from Calvin, but the Reformed tradition generally felt it had little place in worship and mostly was a luxury. Even the later Lutheran tradition had this ambivalence. A very sad example was when Bach was called to a post in the Blasius Church in Mühlhausen, which was a predominantly pietist church. Bach found himself at odds with both the pastor and the congregation, who just wanted simple music and plain vanilla hymn arrangements. Even though Bach had a lot of sympathy for the personal devotion of the pietists and used many of their poems in his cantatas, that environment was, as you can imagine, stifling, and Bach left the church in less than a year. I sometimes wonder how many gifted musicians and artists leave evangelical churches because our music and art is so constricting and childish. Now, honestly, honesty compels me to admit to the fact that Bach may have been influenced by the fact that he was also being offered double the salary elsewhere. That might have had something to do with it. Even artists tend to like to be appreciated financially. Now, of course, when we get to the post-Reformation church, they were very rightly so concerned with truth. But the overweening concern with propositional precision, I think, was a corollary to the intellectualization of life that the Enlightenment embodied. And that intellectualization tended to shove non-intellectual dimensions of life, like art and beauty and emotion, into the margins. The only pleasure allowed was a kind of disembodied spiritual delight in the propositional truth of the gospel. But few people can achieve this because people are not disembodied brains. Puritanism did have some public appeal because their sermons were, whether they recognized it or not, artistic. Puritan sermons, at least the good ones, are more than just a recitation of great intellectual propositions. They communicate even today because in imitation of the Bible that they were drawing their source material from, they use language artistically and creatively in ways that touch the soul and give delight, reflecting the beauty and the desirability of God. Even today, however, I think that many great preachers don't realize that it is their art and not their doctrinal soundness that is attractive to their audience. In reaction to the intellectualization and rationalizing of the 18th century, the 19th century, in a misguided effort to save religion and personality, looked for freedom and meaning in beauty and feeling. This was the dynamic of Romanticism. The church was perhaps more susceptible than the society at large to this because Christians felt threatened by atheistic and deistic rationalism and the skepticism of Hume, and religious feeling seemed like a way to preserve religion, as Schleiermacher would have it. And hence the church was only too quick to adopt the language of Romanticism into its artistic life, something from which it has yet to extricate itself. In our time, the bifurcation of mind and heart has come to the point where both are self-destructing. Personal preference has replaced both the intellectual and the artistic. There is no truth and falsehood. There is no artistic good and bad. There is no beauty or ugliness. Only personal feelings matter. Feelings are now virtually identified with spirituality. The New Age movement, spirituality is essentially feeling. And thinking is actually, in our age, considered to be a hindrance to the work of God's Spirit. Just the opposite of Paul in 1 Corinthians 14. Now, I'm not saying that feelings are unimportant. But it seems now that the only good is feeling good. And to come back to art, art gets subsumed under feelings. People identify art with emotion and suggest that good art is something that arouses feeling. Now, art does indeed excite the emotions, but great art also excites the mind. The great truths of the gospel also excite the emotions, but that doesn't mean that the gospel is what it is because it's emotional. In summary, my little historical survey here, in the medieval church, beauty supplanted truth. The Reformation brought it back, but to some extent at the expense of beauty. Romanticism in the 19th century exalted feelings and redefined truth as beauty. Our own time has relativized both truth and beauty, regarding only feelings as absolute. And that's why we now have churches today that either stress beauty at the expense of truth and feelings, such as the old-style Anglican and Roman churches, or feelings at the expense of truth and beauty, such as many charismatic churches, or, as in my own tradition, truth at the expense of beauty and feelings. I confess, of all of these, I'm compelled to stick with the last, because without truth, beauty and feelings are simply means of self-deception. But truth is not sterile. It ought to manifest beauty and feelings. Truth should evoke passion and creativity in response to the knowledge of God. And if it does not, it calls into question whether a person has really taken the truth to heart. As Jonathan Edwards has so eloquently observed in his treatise on the religious affection. And here's my book plug for this evening. If you have not read the treatise on the religious affections, you must do that. It's one of those books where you read it and paragraph after paragraph, you're ready to shout and say, yes! So please read that book. Well, what is art and why is it relevant to us? Art is the purposeful and skilled restructuring of earthly materials so as to manifest ordered beauty. Again, I'm not going to quibble about what beauty is, but you know what it is. Art is not just beauty, however. It is a human activity that involves communication because it expresses something, but not in propositions. I'm including here four ideas. Art is communicative, art is masterful, art is mysterious, and art is passionate. First, art communicates. In our Western culture, art is sometimes regarded only as objects which invite contemplation of themselves as art objects, as opposed to crafts, which people kind of look down on, which supposedly simply add an aesthetic dimension to functionality. The Christian philosopher Nicholas Walterstorff has challenged this notion and has issued a plea to put art back into life generally as a form of human communicative action. Bach's cantatas, for example, were not intended primarily to draw attention to themselves as art objects, although they're treated that way a lot in our day. They were written to advance the contemplation of God and his word. And yet few would call Bach only a craftsman. True art can communicate masterfully without drawing attention primarily to itself. Art is like language in the way it communicates, inasmuch as the meaning of a bit of language just like the meaning of a work of art, points beyond itself. Art thus can and should adorn and focus attention on something beyond itself. It imposes a certain kind of order and meaning in order to manifest order and meaning. In other words, to communicate. Even art objects, which do invite contemplation of themselves, are successful only if they touch something in the human observer which is outside the work of art itself, allowing that observer to participate in the artist's perception of meaning and to reinterpret that perception in the observer's own experience. And thus, just as God's creation points beyond itself to its creator, God thereby communicating by means of his creation, so art points beyond itself, communicating something beyond the art itself. Secondly, art expresses mystery. Art is a special kind of communication. It communicates in ways that cannot be said in words, unless it's poetry, which is a special kind of art, of course, or a certain prose, of course, is a certain kind of art as well. The word, this message is not a kind of art, so don't. The word mystery can have some negative religious connotations, which are not here in view. But there is an irreducible mystery, using it in the general sense of the word, there's an irreducible mystery about how art communicates. God uses mystery in various ways to communicate more than could be said in propositions, because the beauty of God is not statable only in propositions. Take Psalm 23, for example, that beloved psalm. That psalm does not tell us any proposition that we don't know from elsewhere in Scripture. But our knowledge of God would be considerably lessened if we did not have Psalm 23, would it not? Thirdly, art requires mastery. Art involves a great deal of mastery, demanding much practice and the development of skill to be able to use a medium in a way that can do this mysterious communicating. It's not easy. Ask any of the people that have done some of the art out here how much agony it takes to produce a work of art. God is concerned with mastery. He's concerned with mastery too. In 1 Chronicles 15:22 and 28:21 and Psalm 33:3, God required that the musicians and artisans in his worship be skillful, because the tabernacle and its worship was intended to communicate. And God commanded that it communicate his beauty and his excellence, not ugliness and sloppiness. If either the mystery or the mastery is missing, it's not art and does not succeed at communicating truly. Fourthly, art manifests passion. The Church of the Middle Ages thought quite a bit about artistic beauty and understood it as involving four attributes: proportion or balance, clarity or light, symbolism, and integrity or wholeness. Beauty in art was a reflection of God's proportion, clarity, communication, and perfections. But there's another dimension to art as a reflection of God's beauty that I want to add, the dimension of passion. I'm not talking about the passion of a romantic conception of love, but the human dynamic that provides the drive and the power behind communication. For example, one of the deepest passions is suffering, which is a great stimulus to a lot of art. In fact, the greatest and the most powerful art has ever been the result of the combination of the greatest mastery with the deepest suffering. Michelangelo was a deep suffering person. Or to give you another illustration, compare Mendelssohn and Beethoven. Most people know a little bit of Beethoven. Mendelssohn they might know a little bit of by accident, but Mendelssohn seems kind of lightweight compared with Beethoven. Well, I actually think that that Mendelssohn had more raw talent than Beethoven did, but Beethoven suffered immensely. Felix Mendelssohn was well named. He had a pretty nice life, and I think as a result, his art, for all its delightfulness, just does not touch the soul the way that that Beethoven does. Or, you know, I keep talking about Bach. I'm sorry, I really like Bach. But compare the youthful Bach, who wrote things like the Toccata and Fugue, which is the only piece that I don't like anymore by Bach because they play it so much. But compare that, which is kind of frivolous in a sense, in a way, with the with say the great Mass in B minor or the Passions that he wrote towards the end of his life. In the early period, he hadn't suffered much, but after he had lost his first wife by very tragic, sudden circumstances, and had buried a majority of his 20. Everybody knows that Bach had 20 children. What most people don't realize is he buried 11 of them, died in fairly young age. Anyway, the deepest art, I think, is an exceedingly fitting vehicle for expressing the deepest joy, precisely because it is a way of expressing the deepest suffering. It is perhaps worth noting that those churches which have the deepest experience of suffering in their history, I'm thinking, for example, of the Armenian Church, whose theology I do not espouse, but they have a liturgy of the profoundest beauty and the most deep joy in their worship. Hence, if I can summarize, art is a kind of humanly shaped beauty characterized by communicative mystery, technical mastery, and passion. Now, what does this have to do with our aesthetic obligation in displaying the image of God? Glorifying God means acknowledging, recounting, and adulating the virtues of God. When we finally see God, his awesome, majestic, glorious, holy beauty will rivet our attention upon him for eon after eon. To expunge beauty from any part of our service to God, or to neglect it, is to delete from our consciousness one of God's attributes, and this doesn't honor God. Furthermore, if the medieval theologians were right, and earthly beauty is there because its creator is beautiful, then think about God's extravagance, almost profligacy, in the beauty of creation. Surely that ought to cue us into something. God surely takes pleasure in his own beauty and the beauty that he has made. Why else should there be magnificent caverns, gorgeous deep sea fish, and deep space objects of incredible beauty, which until recently lay open to no eyes but his? If God and his works are beautiful, then a life devoid of beauty is not just missing something. It's an insult to its creator. But how are we going to evince that beauty if we take no action? And action with respect to beauty is art. I know this is not a conference about art in worship, but if worship is the most important thing that we do, it cannot be entirely sidelined in any discussion about the Christian and art. And yet worship in the typical evangelical church today is an artistic desert. Formless and graceless prayers, haphazard liturgy, hymns of ghastly poetry set to sentimental music, or else repetitive and childish songs devoid of all but the most basic and prosaic content, sermons that are more effective than sermonettes, all done in the most uninspiring and acoustically necrotic buildings, bedecked with amateurish posters and banners reminiscent of nursery school. It's no wonder, pardon the hyperbole, it's no wonder that the church today fails to touch the soul. But God is not like that. Think for a moment about God's extravagance in ordaining the simplest things with beauty. Jesus says, "Consider the lilies of the field. They neither toil nor spin, and yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all his glory was arrayed like one of these." If God is so lavish in adorning a weed on a hillside, why are we so stinting in adorning the most important acts of our lives, especially our worship? And so, now I'm finally getting to the Bible passage. I want to look at how the aesthetic obligation operates with respect to worship. First, before I read the passage, isn't it interesting that the very first person in the Bible whom God declares is filled with the Spirit of God is an artist? Bezalel in Exodus 31. How many people have heard of Bezalel? You don't need to raise your hands, but He is equipped by the Spirit to produce an artistic environment for worship. Elsewhere, being filled with or having the Spirit of God is descriptive of prophets. Artistic ability is a spiritual gift and is somewhat akin to prophecy. Bezalel and his assistant Aholiab built a beautiful tabernacle because beauty is appropriate to divine worship. Their activity is echoed in 2 Chronicles, which describes Solomon's building of the temple. Interesting here is that Solomon sent to Hiram of Tyre for the best artists. He didn't use local talent. Someone will point out that in the Old Testament, a beautiful building was appropriate because that was the time of typical worship. But now, all the symbolism of the tabernacle and all its adornment has been fulfilled in Christ. Now we worship not at a single physical location in an earthly Jerusalem. And perhaps, if we were purely spiritual beings, we wouldn't need to have any physical expression of beauty in our environment when we worship. But the fact is that we are bodies as well as spirits. And that requires the embodiment of beauty if we are to appreciate it. Not as a direct visual representation of God's beauty, which is impossible and which we are forbidden to try, but as an indirect artistic pointer to what God's beauty is like. And if I can put a plug for my own artistic interest here, especially through music. You cannot escape the aesthetic dimensions of your experience. Either your environment will support and reinforce your sense of who God is, or it will work against it. There is no neutral ground. Think for a moment. Based on the aesthetic dimension of your worship, would an observer conclude that your God is holy and beautiful? Or would he conclude that your God is childish, or nonchalant, or ugly, or, on the other hand, ostentatious or garish? To the Old Testament saints, the future glory of God's house was couched in terms of visible, physical beauty. Although the shadow is not the reality, the shadows should certainly reflect and convey the reality. Yes, we have an already that the Old Testament did not have, and yet we also still have a not yet. So we still need to reflect that beauty in our environment. Why? Because we are human beings, and we perceive and experience reverence and awe in aesthetic categories. And here I finally made it to my text, Psalm 96. It has a great deal to teach us because it ties these things together by referring to the splendor or beauty of holiness. The holiness of God reflected in the aesthetic dimensions of worship. Sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord, all the earth. Sing to the Lord, praise his name. Proclaim his salvation day after day. Declare his glory among the nations, his marvelous deeds among all the peoples. For great is the Lord and most worthy of praise. He is to be feared above all gods. For all the gods of the nations are idols. But the Lord made the heavens. Splendor and majesty are before him. Strength and glory are in his sanctuary. Ascribe to the Lord, O families of nations. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts. Worship the Lord in the splendor of his holiness. Tremble before him, all the earth. Say among the nations, the Lord reigns. The world is firmly established. It cannot be moved. He will judge the peoples with equity. Let the heavens rejoice. Let the earth be glad. Let the sea resound and all that is in it. Let the fields be jubilant and everything in them. And then all the trees of the forest will sing for joy. They will sing before the Lord, for he comes. He comes to judge the earth. He will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples in his truth. The psalmist rightly links fear and trembling and splendor and majesty and beauty, echoed in the aesthetic response of splendor and beauty and majesty in worship. And likewise, God's justice and truth have their aesthetic response in singing and joy. And note how important singing is here to worship. Preaching is for now, but singing is forever. God is glorious and beautiful, and therefore his worshipers exhibit glory and beauty in their worship. Our worship, one worships in the splendor of holiness, or holy splendor, if you like. It probably refers in its original context to the garments that were worn by the priests. Worship is the highest and most basic calling of humanity. And what people do in worship is largely what people are. It's what we were created for. And therefore, what we are includes the fact that we are inescapably, through and through, aesthetic creatures. And one thing we are created for is to engage in aesthetic creativity. Not that we are all called to be professional artists, or writers, or musicians, or dancers. Most of us are not so gifted. But we are all called upon to be artistically expressive, to appreciate all the arts, and to participate in creating beauty to the extent that we can, even to the point of expenditure of money. By all means, be careful to worship God only as he has commanded. But if scrupulousness becomes stinginess or aridity, it can hardly serve to make his creatures more aware of his glory. Think again of Mary and her using up that expensive ointment to anoint Jesus. I suspect that most of us would tend to agree with Judas on that one, wouldn't we? What possible justification could there be for such an extravagant, wasteful use of resources by fairly poor people? Only that it was a fitting act. If not God's extravagant creation of beauty, if not God's extravagant creation of beauty all around us, then certainly God's extravagant self-sacrifice for us ought to elicit an extravagant response from us. And that includes extravagantly fulfilling our aesthetic obligation to reflect God's own beauty and his extravagant creation of beauty in our lives. Is our God beautiful and glorious and majestic and splendorous, both in his being and in his actions? Then let's display it in our own actions, including in the aesthetic dimension of our lives, as well as the intellective. Skillfully and passionately communicating the glorious splendor of God. Ascribe to the Lord, O families of the nations. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due to his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts. Worship the Lord in the splendor of his holiness. Tremble before him.